Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I have a man who literally needs no introduction. This is Charles Petzold, from whom most of us learned to program Windows, and the author of Programming Windows 6th Edition, as well as numerous other books. How are you, Charles?
Good, good.
It's great to have you here again. I also have with us John Galloway, my time-to-time co-host on yet another podcast. And John, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Great. I have the two of you. You both sound good. Let's dive right in, Charles, by asking you about your newest edition of Programming Windows, the 6th edition.
Yeah, it's about Windows 8.
So you also made the decision to code for Programming Windows 6th edition in C# and XAML.
Right. At first, that was an easy decision for me because I've been working with C# since, the past 10 years. And I haven't been doing any C++ programming during all that time. So it seemed like a very obvious decision to me. And then a couple potential readers started questioning that decision. And I did a blog entry basically throwing it open for discussion. And I got a lot of feedback on both sides of the issue. And it's been rather interesting to me because it's not like the decision to go with C# or C++ for .NET, where you're working with basically two managed languages. Because the difference with Windows 8 programming, the difference between C# and C++ is a difference between a managed language and a non-managed language. I found it to be a difficult decision ultimately. And what I did, and partially to compromise, is that even though the book is entirely C# and XAML, of course, all the sample code from all the chapters, I am converting them over to C++ as well, which is has been an illuminating experience, to say the least. C++ has changed a lot since the last time I used it, and it's been challenging. And of course, there's stuff that there's certain things that are very easy to do in C# because you have a good chunk of the system namespaces available to you when you're doing Windows 8 programming. But all that stuff is gone in C++. You're working with C++ libraries for some of these chores.
Well, you've raised a couple questions. Let's talk briefly about how C++ has changed in the past decade.
Oh gosh, it's changed when I wasn't looking at it. So many of those changes, I'm just learning about them as I'm attempting to convert these programs over to C++. There have been some familiar types of constructions that we are familiar with from C#, like the for each statement, for example. You can now do that in C++, and C++ has gained some of the collections that we're accustomed to. There's a vector and map that are similar to the .NET list and dictionary. Things like that. There seems to be cases where you can have objects deleted for you instead of doing malloc and deletes all over the place. So to some extent, C++ has become a friendlier language. On the other hand, C++ just has decades worth of baggage. And it's difficult to know in some cases what library solution you should be using for a particular case.
But a key difference, as you pointed out, between C++ and C# is that one is managed and the other isn't. Now, to my naive way of thinking about it, that's a trade-off of performance, or at least theoretical performance, against garbage collection. And in that case, that's an easy decision for me to make. But am I missing something beyond that?
That's a good part of it. But when you're compiling, even for Windows 8, when you're compiling a C# program, you're getting intermediate language, IL, that is then compiled into native code when the programs actually run. When you're coding in C++ for Windows 8, you're getting actual native code. You're generating native code. So you'd have to compile your program separately for a 32-bit process, Intel processor, or a 64-bit processor, or an ARM processor. All those are separate binaries in, when you're coding in C++. So the code, because the compiler is doing the code instead of the just-in-time translator that's associated with managed code, because the compiler is actually doing the optimizing in C++, you get much better optimization. And I did a blog entry a week or so ago where I looked at some heavy processing code involving twisting an image, a bitmap image around, and found that the C++ code can be significantly faster. Of course, once it hits the API, it's exactly the same.
How does that all work with the when you're working in Windows 8, you're in a different kind of sandbox than you've been in Windows pretty much forever, right? I mean, you're in kind of a sandbox, so like a different kind of underlying platform. How does that work with C++? Like, I would imagine in .NET as a managed platform, we're kind of used to, you know, working inside of some kind of sandbox. So how does that match up with C++ development experience?
From what I understand, once you hit the API, you're not in any kind of sandbox whatsoever. So the big benefit that you get from, that's not entirely true either, because there are, if you're writing a type of app that formerly known as Metro style app, there's a lot of APIs that you can't use, a lot of Win32 APIs you can't use, or you can't use a DLL that goes into those Win32 APIs. There's a subset of Win32 APIs you can use, but there's many others that you cannot. So that your program, I believe it's when you submit the program to the Windows Store, stuff like that would be checked. So to that extent, you're running in a sandbox. I am not sure what actually happens at runtime to prohibit a Metro-style app, forgive me for using the word, from hitting the forbidden Win32 APIs. Otherwise, whether you're coding in a C++ or C sharp, for the new APIs, the Windows runtime APIs, you're going at them basically through COM. So it's, that is the same. Once you're in the API, you should be the same, and it should be fast and as efficient as possible, because it's all native code at that point. I think what you really get out of C sharp and managed code is a better debugging during development. You also get things like array checking, which is often very important. You can't use pointers you can use pointers, but you have to specifically put those in unsafe blocks. So, you're protected against errand pointers and things like that.
Not to mention memory management and not having.
Yeah. So, the garbage collection, at least on the program side of the API.
Okay, I'm still not convinced that I need to look at C++, and it strikes me as a marginal, except for certain applications where it's crystal clear that you absolutely need it, either for performance or for DirectX.
Yeah, I agree. It is a big trade. The big trade-off is between the program efficiency and a programmer productivity. I think we're all agreed that a good C-sharp programmer can generate more code than a good C++ programmer, more bug-free code. You can also be assured that the program is running correctly than if it's coded in C++. But if you really need those CPU cycles on the program end of it, really you're leaning towards C++. And you mentioned DirectX, and that has become a very interesting part of this new era of Windows development with Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8 as well. And I don't think that is insignificant. I see DirectX as being applicable for much more than games, where it's pretty much required.
You know, one example I've seen of that is in Office. Like, Office recently made some big change, you know, change the rendering system to use a lot, you know, the direct family of things, you know, DirectX, mm-hmm. like DirectType, DirectShow kind of stuff. And it does make a difference. I mean, I'm mostly using it on desktop, but I am seeing, you know, just the animations, the transitions are really fluid. So, you know, I originally would have thought, you know, DirectX is for games and media processing and media kind of stuff. But I can see that, you know, that it's just people are expecting that kind of smooth experience and on, you know, lower hardware specifications too.
Yeah, I can give you a couple examples of where DirectX is important to something that you might think it would be entirely a C-sharp program, and which would be entirely a C-sharp program if you were doing it in Silverlight. And these several things, we may say, yikes, the Windows Runtime API is missing this stuff. Yet it's not there. So what can we do? First thing is, if you're writing entirely in C-sharp using the Windows Runtime API, which is required for a Metro-style app, you cannot get a list of system fonts. All right? If you want to put up a dialog box where the user can pick a font, you can't do it. And you need to go to DirectWrite and get a list of system fonts. Now that can be fairly easy. You can put it in a C++ DLL and just call it from your C-sharp program. But still, it's kind of weird that you need to use DirectWrite for that job. Another one that I recently came across when I was doing my bitmap chapter is a writable bitmap. In Silverlight, we have two ways to change the bits of a writable bitmap, to change the pixels. One is you directly access the array of pixel bits and you can change them at will. Another way is that you can render elements on the image. If you want a line, you can use the line element, the normal XAML line element, and put that on a writable bitmap. And that's how you can render a line on there. Well, that second part is not available in the Windows 8 writable bitmap. So if you want to draw a line on a bitmap, which you'll want to do if you are, for example, writing a finger painting program, you're either doing your own line drawing algorithms and implementing those by actually manipulating the pixel bits, or you're using DirectX to put stuff onto a bitmap. The third example, say you want to play some music or some sounds. There is no sound API in the Windows runtime. If you want your app to make some noise, you're using Direct Sound. Those are three examples of things that you can do in Silverlight purely in C-sharp that you cannot do in Windows 8 purely in C-sharp.
Let's take that last one. Is that an acknowledged temporary situation, or is that put forward as this is by design?
I have no idea. It may be that, I don't know. It's hard to see how the Windows 8.1, the Windows runtime API of Windows 8.1 or so will have some of the more stuff we've been accustomed to in Silverlight. I don't know. I have no idea. But it could be that there's been a conscious decision made that if you want to do a lot of this high-end graphics or sound stuff, you really should be using DirectX. I actually feel some sympathy towards that. If you're generating sound in real time in Silverlight and you're doing it in C#, you're probably doing it inefficiently. It's made Windows 8 and Windows, it's made us think very differently about programming platforms now and programming languages with Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8. It has forced us to say, well, we no longer have a one language fits all solution. If there are certain types of apps you want to write, you're doing it in C++.
Is it possible? Are there libraries, or is it possible to do, to make effective use of DirectX from C#?
Yeah, I mean, you can. I'm going to have a half of a chapter devoted to this, and I've done some work with it. And if you want to get a list of system fonts, for example, it's a very trivial exercise. There are some libraries available. There's what's it called? DirectX, something like that.
I've seen one Sharp DX.
Yeah, Sharp DX. That's it. That is it. And what they've done is they've generated an interface for you that you can use from C Sharp and call the DirectX functions. You probably, though, if you are using DirectX in a non-trivial way, for example, if you are actually using it to generate music in real time, if you are coding a synthesizer app, for example, or you're doing a lot of high-end drawing, or you're doing an ebook reader where you need to generate pages very quickly, you're forced to use DirectX for those jobs to a certain extent, but you probably want to write a lot of the surrounding code in C++ as well to get the native code efficiency for that.
Well, that certainly broadens, and I would say almost in a disturbing way, my understanding.
Yeah, I've gotten old enough where I don't get indignant about these things. That they should have given us these APIs, and they're screwing our C-sharp programmers, you know. I'm treating it more like it's the fact of life. This is how the people who are making these decisions have delivered this thing to us, and so we make the best of it. Is that a good attitude?
I found that to be helpful with a lot of things in Windows 8.
I found that to be helpful with a lot of things, period.
To accept the things we cannot change. As
yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about your book from the beginning. It starts off fairly gently with a description of markup and XAML syntax, and then picks up the pace pretty rapidly. And what I found when I was reading it was it felt very much like a Charles Petzold book. And by that I mean it felt very much like, okay, here's how to program Windows 8, but there are some things that I'm just really interested in that I want to tell you about.
I can't help that. that's how it turns out to be. There's stuff that I like to do. It's I know there's weak stuff in my books and there's strong stuff in my books. When I was writing the very first edition of Programming Windows in 1987, there were no other Windows programming books out. I was working on this book. I was spending many months on it, and I went to the local Barnes and Noble, and there was a Windows programming book on the shelves, the first one ever. It was that one that had like the four authors, including Paul Yao. And I bought it and brought it home, and I didn't take it out of the wrapper, out of the bag. I was afraid to look at it. And then a couple weeks later, I finished a chapter on metafiles, Windows metafiles, which to some extent, I mean, you could argue that in the grand scheme of things, metafiles were not very important to Windows programming, but I found vector graphics very interesting at the time, and I wanted to do this chapter on metafiles, and I spent a lot of time on it. I did a lot of experimentation, learned a lot of things, had more information about metafiles, Windows metafiles, than I had ever seen. And I wondered what this other book had about metafiles. And metafiles wasn't even in the index. So yeah, people can write different books on the same subject and have completely different orientations.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I think that made your book stand out and become the classic that it is was not just that it was one of the first books on Windows, but that you took the reader on an adventure. I mean, you told a story about Windows and about programming Windows and about what's interesting and puzzling and fun about Windows. And this new book feels very much the same.
Thank you.
I'll just stop there then.
People used to buy one of these books and read it all the way through and, you know, learn the stuff as they were going along. I don't think people do that much anymore. People tend to use books when they get stuck on a particular problem and there's no other solution. Their favorite search engine is just not providing a solution. I say, well, I wonder what's in this book that I paid for and never looked at. And they look it up and, oh yeah, okay, if they're lucky. So people are using the books as reference these days. But I still feel a need to write it as a tutorial. And when you're writing it as a tutorial, you're imposing basically a narrative on this API. This big giant API, you're forging a path through it. You're starting at a particular point and you take things one at a time and you go through this path in a single direction, which is kind of required of a book. And so that imposes a narrative on the material, and somebody reading the book from beginning to end, gets the material in a very ordered way. Where they don't suddenly encounter things they've never seen before. Things are presented in an orderly manner. I still write the books like that, even though I don't think many people actually use them like that.
It would be interesting to find a way to find out how people are using books. Certainly, we know that the way people are learning has changed. We know that there's a lot more quality information online, and book sales are not what they used to was, no doubt about that. So it would be interesting to know, are people purely using them for reference, or are they using them when they first start to get grounded, or after they've already have a grounding and now they want some depth? I'm not sure how you would get at those questions.
Yeah, I'm not sure I really want to know the answers, if you know what I mean.
Fair enough.
You have to be very naive and have a lot of faith to write a book these days.
Yep. I wonder almost if there would eventually be, as a lot of things move to ebooks, if there's any kind of possibility for tracking. Like, I wouldn't mind opting in to letting somebody see which chapters I refer to or read a lot, or how far I get in a book, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Again, a little scary.
yeah, true.
Yes, the fall off after page 40 would be very precipitous, I'm afraid.
But I mean, I recently, about a month or so ago, I did a chapter on printing for this new book, and it was that I had a chapter on printing in the first edition of Programming Windows, and I've always tried to put a chapter on printing in, even in the .NET books and all, because I think it's important. Other authors tend to ignore the subject. So you know, I like to think that, yeah, even if people are no longer using the books as a tutorial, if they need to know something about printing, I have a whole chapter on printing. And you know, if that chapter saves you a half an hour of time, the book is basically paid for itself, hasn't it?
Indeed. And your book is going to save a lot. I mean, speaking as somebody who is writing with John a book that is arguably a competitor book, I will say that your book is still going to be required reading for anybody who's doing Windows programming.
So you guys have taken the C# approach as well? Is that, or?
We have. We're doing a book for A-Press that will be on Windows 8 programming, and we chose C# and XAML in large measure for me because that's what I know, and also because as I've talked to people on the podcast who are programming in both, the feeling, although everyone always begins with choose the one you're most comfortable with or you already know, the feeling for folks who are doing both seems to be that XAML is a more productive environment.
Yeah, it's interesting that at least the vibe we were getting from Build last year was that Microsoft seemed to be pushing the JavaScript and HTML solution more. I thought that was a little peculiar. While JavaScript, it's great for, you know, doing web pages and all, I don't really see it as the optimum language for production coding for an enterprise app, for example, or a commercial app for that matter. It's just too slippery a language, is it not? What's your view on that?
You know, I'm learning more and more that JavaScript, there are a lot of, it's one of these, you know, like Go or whatever. It's one of those things where there's just so much depth to it over time. Mm-hmm. I used to see it as a simple scripting language, and then I've run up against people that are doing insane things with it and deeply understand it as a language. So with things like Node.js, I mean, people are building more complex frameworks and, and things on top of it. So I'm certain that people are going to build, you know, large systems for Windows 8 in JavaScript, but I think that it doesn't naturally lend itself to that. Like, you have to have discipline and you have to know a good amount about it to, you know, to keep things organized. Whereas C Sharp is more of a, you know, it has a structure to it that's going to kind of keep you hopefully a little bit more, you know, on the rails.
See, now my approach to this is I have this fantasy of the powers that be at Microsoft, and I'm making this up, so I have no inside information about this. But if I were them sitting down, I would say, stipulate for a moment that they're both equally viable languages for building Windows 8 applications. Okay, we need to have XAML as a natural path for the Silverlight and WPF programmer and the Windows Phone programmer. But where else are they going to go? They're going to go to XAML. Now, how do we expand our audience of developers? Well, there are a boatload of JavaScript web developers out there. And if we can come up with a solution that lets them code to Windows 8, then maybe we start migrating more developers into this stack. And that was my sense at Build, was that it wasn't so much the message was JavaScript is better than XAML for building. It was JavaScript expands the audience of people who can build Windows 8 apps.
Yeah, when they hired all those interns to do Windows 8 apps, for the tablet they gave out, they were all done in JavaScript, were they not? That was my impression.
The vast majority, and that's because those young whippersnappers.
Yeah, I guess so. That's what they know. I don't know. If I were Microsoft, I'd be a little afraid of HTML. I'd be very afraid of HTML5. If it really is, I mean, the promise of it is that it'll make things operating system independent and just rely on the browser for rendering things. I don't know. It conceivably, if HTML5 came out to be really, really good and powerful, it would kill Windows, would it not?
Well, I think we're a long way between killing Windows. I think that with 60 million, is that what I read? Windows 7 installations.
Wow.
I think it'll be a while before they're worried about the death of Windows, but expansion is important, and having a viable competitor. I mean, you know, we remember OS 2 and barely, and there hasn't been really a viable competitor. The Mac and Linux, you know, have very, very small relative market share on numbers of installations. So you're right. I think HTML5 in the long run, I mean, what do I know about what the business reality is, whether they're attempting to co-opt or get on the bandwagon or make themselves more flexible? But there's nothing out there today that has the power or even the attraction of Windows 8, at least to my somewhat biased eyes. Now, before we get too deep in the mud on this, you have had a fascinating career and made some interesting decisions about what kinds of books you're going to write. Because some of your books are these fairly practical working programmer books, and some of your books are these lyrical excursions into other topics you're interested in. And maybe we could talk about that for just a couple of minutes.
Yeah, it was... just to give you an idea about how I feel about this, the books I've written. When I joined Facebook several years ago, they wanted to, you one of the things you do when you're defining your profile is to describe yourself in a sentence or so. And Facebook is refusing to come up right now. But what I said was that I was the author of Code, the Hidden Language of Computer Hardware and Software, and The Annotated Turing, a guided tour through Alan Turing's historic paper on computability and the Turing machine, and several books on Windows programming.
That's brilliant.
That's how I feel about it, if you really want to know. I mean, I recognize the importance of programming Windows, particularly 20 years ago, when there were a lot of DOS programmers who realized, yikes, I need to learn how to code for Windows. And programming Windows was there. And those two editions, the second and third editions, which were on Windows 3 and Windows 3.1, sold a lot of copies, and people really use those books to learn how to code for Windows. But, you know, I know that these programming tutorials are, you know, worthless after a few years. But code in the annotated Turing to me, conceivably would be read, you know, maybe even 10, 20 years from now. So that's nice to be able to write that kind of book. And I hope to be able to write more of those kind of books. We shall see.
What are the pressures on building, on writing that kind of book in terms of getting them published and making them pay for your time?
Yeah, it's problematic. I cannot explain what the book is really like. I went for years trying to tell people what kind of book code was. And, they'd say, well, it's a How Computer Works book, right? You know, and not exactly. It's different from that. And I finally had to write 100 pages, the first 100 pages of the book, and, give it to my agent, Claudette Moore, who, sent it off to Microsoft. And then people finally understood what the book was about. Of course, once they understand that, they want to give you a book contract and they impose a deadline on you. And you've had all this leisure time in which to write, you know, the first part of the book, and then all of a sudden you're on a deadline and all. The annotated Turing was something similar. The annotated Turing takes Alan Turing's historic 1936 paper on computability, presents it in full, but annotates the hell out of it. And I had to convince myself that I was going to be able to do this. So that took a long time, and all. And of course, this time that you're working on books like this, in order just to get to a point where you can convince yourself that you can write the book, and where you're at a point where you can go to your agent or a publisher and say, this is a book I want to write. That takes a long time and you're not getting paid for it. So you have to be in a financial position where you can spend all this time. And it used to be that this was funded, these two books were funded by my J job, which was writing programming tutorials and writing magazine articles. But that has become even more difficult because the programming tutorials no longer sell the way they used to. So in the past several years, I've found myself doing consulting and then getting to a point where I can do some more writing that doesn't have a direct payoff. But it's become very difficult. I mean, everybody has, you know, is experiencing tough times these past several years. So, but in the writing business, it's really become difficult.
Is there a book that's waiting to be written?
Oh, there's about a half dozen of them. there are. I have particular interests in what is sometimes called the prehistory of computing, which is stuff that involves computing or assisted math prior to the 1930s. All right. In the 1930s, it was really the start of digital computers, if you forget about Charles Babbage, for example. But I am interested in exploring analog computers. I am interested in exploring not the core of what Charles Babbage did, but some peripheral stuff to Babbage. I am interested in exploring the way that punched cards developed historically. I am interested in exploring logarithms as a computational tool. Some of these books are in a one of these books several summers ago, I wrote like four chapters and wasn't very happy with the way it was going. So I would like to spend next year trying to do that book again. Whether I'm going to be able to or not, I don't know. I may try to do a mix of consulting and working on this particular book, which would mean not doing any programming tutorials or magazine articles. And that's kind of extreme too. That would be kind of like dropping out of the Windows world. So I don't know. I'm in a state of I don't know. Every day I think a different solution. Every day I think I'm going to do something different, but I don't know. Right now, I'm on a deadline, so fortunately, my days are not flexible. I don't have to think about it.
And the deadline you're on is for this Windows book, which has an interesting marketing approach that you can purchase it as an ebook early or an ebook when it's completed and or a printed book.
Yeah, and the price keeps going up depending upon when you buy into it. It's this was one of the ways in which my publisher Microsoft Press got me intrigued about doing the sixth edition. Besides the idea of doing a Windows 8 book that I could do in C#, there are basically three installments of this book. And the first one was the first seven chapters, and it was based on the developer preview of Windows 8. So it was called the preview ebook. And that was for 2 weeks. That was purchasable for $10. And then the price went up to $20. And then recently, several additional chapters became available, and we called it the release preview ebook. And that was for 2 weeks. $30, and now it's up to $40. But if you had bought it back when it was $10, you would have gotten the update free, and you get the final ebook for free as well. So it was an interesting way to perhaps entice a lot of readers early on to invest $10, which is not a whole lot of money as these things go, and get a whole book in mid-November.
I like it. I feel like I missed out, but at the same time, I got a good deal by getting in on the early part of the second series. So it's an interesting marketing approach.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if anybody else tries to emulate it. I mean, it's a lot more work on the author's part, because I'm here trying to, you know, get chapters in a state where they can actually be read by people. And also when we've had these two preliminary releases, it's been a lot of work that's centered around that release, that would normally be used in writing other chapters. So, and plus we've done it in such a way where the deadline is so solid. And that's difficult for writers as well. I mean, very often deadlines are missed when books are written. And I know a lot of my early books, I missed deadlines. But this, because of the structure of its release, the deadlines were very rigid. And that's difficult too. And it's a rigid deadline could mean the difference between, it's not just that you can get the same amount of material out regardless when it's due. It could be that there's a chapter that you want to write that you're not going to have time to write. And so, but I like deadlines. Deadlines are important for focusing the mind and getting things done. Without deadlines, I don't think I'd ever actually finish a book.
Before I let you go, tell me your general feelings about Windows 8 and the Metro style application. Were you pleased, excited by these, or distraught, or how did you react to it when you saw all of this?
I'm not going to answer that question directly.
Fair enough.
I am very intrigued by the idea that instead of the previous approach that Microsoft had taken of having this Windows API and trying to impose it on smaller devices where it doesn't quite fit, of going from the other direction of first, we first saw this new style UI in Windows Phone 7, and then it became available in Windows 8, and most people first started, most developers first started using Windows 8 on the tablets we got at build, and it's a nice little tablet UI, isn't it? And all this touch stuff is built in, which I think is very important. But then I've never really, even though I have Windows 8, I have the setup I'm using to write the book is that I'm running Windows 8 on the build tablet, and I have Visual Studio installed there, and I'm using a second monitor attached to that, but I have the tablet docked, and I'm using a second monitor to actually run Visual Studio. So, you know, I haven't been using the UI of Windows 8 all that much, but it's been very amusing to me to see old-time Windows programmers write blogs and other comments about how they hate the Windows 8 UI, and it's just awful. They can't use it. But we had the same kind of stuff going on when Windows was first released. And you had these old-time DOS users who were complaining about Windows, and they couldn't use the mouse, and it's just too restrictive and all. And so it's like a replay of that again. It's a UI that's a little too advanced for the old fogies. Many of us who have been using Windows for 10 or 20 years certainly qualify as old fogies at this point. I'm going to have to really see what Windows 8 is like when I start using it as a user instead of a developer. I'm kind of curious about that. I mean, this book has consumed so much of my time that I haven't really been able to just sit back in a chair with a Windows 8 tablet and like use it as from a user's perspective instead of coding for it. So I don't know. There's a big question whether touch is useful on the desktop. And you get this phenomenon called if you have your arm on your desktop screen a lot, you get this phenomenon called gorilla arm, where your arm gets very fatigued. But I don't know if the desktop form factor might not evolve in a way to accommodate touch. Maybe it no longer has sense to have monitors that sit vertically on the desktop. Maybe the monitors should be tilted downward a bit, more like a drafting table. And I've been kind of intrigued about that idea of maybe like trying to rig something up here and seeing if that's a better approach to using touch on the desktop. Because I do think that touch is an extremely important innovation in UI.